Hi, my name is Jess Graham, and I'm the community builder at the Transnational Institute, and I'm here to ask for your help. The work of TNI is important and cannot be done without financial resources. If you like the work we do, I encourage you to support TNI. You will help us to continue strengthening international social movements with research, reliable information, sound analysis, and constructive proposals that advance progressive, democratic policy change and common solutions to global problems. We need your help to retain a loud and independent voice in this environment. Please go to tni.org and at the top of the page, click Support Us. You can make a one-off donation or sign up as a friend of TNI and pledge a regular contribution that will help us to continue the vital work being done. Thanks a lot.
Why are US-China relations deteriorating? What are the impacts of growing anti-Asian racism on Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders, AAPI, living in the US? Will the new Cold War with China replace the US War on Terror? In this interview, Toby Taichao argues that the rise of China as an economic power has become a clear threat to US hegemony. While the pandemic served as a catalyst for anti-Asian racism, it was not the root cause. Increasingly hostile foreign policy towards China leads to increasingly hostile domestic policy towards people perceived to be Asian. But AAPI communities are fighting back. Toby Taichao is the founding director of Justice is Global at the People's Action Institute, a network of state and local grassroots power-building organizations united in fighting for justice. He's an organizer, a political educator, and a leading progressive strategist and critic regarding US-China relations and the rise of xenophobia in the US. Arun Kundanani is a TNI associate and author of The Muslims Are Coming, Islamophobia, Extremism, and the Domestic War on Terror.
Hello, my name's Arun Kundanani, and in this series of interviews, we meet people who can lay out a different vision of what global security should look like in an age of pandemics and climate breakdown. In this video, I met with Toby Taichao. We talked about the growing anti-Chinese sentiment in US political discourse, the interests that are driving US rivalry with China, and the possibilities for grassroots organizing in response. If you enjoy the video, please like and subscribe and look out for the next video, which will drop in about a month. Toby, thank you for joining us today. We'll get straight into talking about how foreign policy elites in the United States have shifted in their attitudes to China. Just a few years ago, if we think back, China was seen as a kind of partner in a process of globalization. And the assumption was that as China became more integrated into the global economy, that democratic reforms would kind of follow out of that process. But if you look at how, for example, the Democrats talk about China now, they've completely shifted from that position, it seems, and now see China as a kind of global rival, a kind of threat to American interests. What explains this shift?
Yes, you mentioned the sort of story that neoliberal elites in the U.S. were telling themselves that China's integration with the neoliberal form of globalization would bring about democratization. And the failure of that to turn towards nationalism and authoritarianism in China and the increased repression and also militarization that we're seeing from China, threats to Taiwan and so on. Like, these are important features of the growing anti-China sentiment, but in my opinion, they're not really fundamental. We can see from other aspects of US foreign policy that concerns for democracy and human rights of under foreign governments is not really the priority overall for the US foreign policy establishment. They'll invoke it when it's convenient and they'll ignore the provisions when it suits their purposes as well. I think what's more foundational is that the rise of China, and in particular as an economic power, has started to become a clear threat to US hegemony. to U.S. military and economic domination over the rest of the world. And that is, above all, the core commitment of the foreign policy establishment. This is a bipartisan commitment among both Democrats and Republicans. And it is the economic rise of China as a threat to that form of U.S. hegemony, global hegemony, that is the most fundamental driver of this turn towards anti-China sentiment. So that's both China as an overall economic power, but also more specifically as a part of that, the rise of very powerful Chinese firms that are becoming competitors with U.S. firms in some strategically important sectors. So we can think of the tech sector, Chinese tech companies that are now competing with U.S. tech companies. Also, we can look at clean energy companies. You know, this is the energy of the future, the industries of the future. This is how Democrats talk about it. And there are some areas of clean tech industry where Chinese companies are just very clearly not just competing with other rivals, but dominating, very clearly dominating the global markets. So what we see is a growing sort of intercapitalist rivalry between the US and China that is threatening to escalate towards inter-imperialist rivalry. That is the most important factor driving this now bipartisan embrace of a kind of anti-China nationalism. And again, human rights violations, repression from the Chinese government. These are just important issues in themselves. They are also something that U.S. elites worry about. But again, I think like it would be a mistake to see those as like the priority commitments that are driving things. They get invoked because it gives a kind of moral veneer to an agenda that is fundamentally about protecting U.S. power.
Mm-hmm. And so you mentioned this is bipartisan, but are there differences between how the Democrats and the Republicans approach this area?
Yeah, there are some differences. So one difference is that Republicans are willing to be more explicitly racist and jingoistic in their anti-China narratives, and Democrats will often try to moderate that, although I think very often these turn out to be more a cosmetic kind of thing. Another more substantial difference, I would say, is that the approach that we're seeing from Democrats is an anti-China strategy that really emphasizes building an alliance, building like international alliances. So they build this as like, we're building an alliance of like liberal democracies, and they point towards Europe and Japan and so on. But of course, they're also cultivating alliances with countries that cannot be classified as liberal democracies or are strongly backsliding from democracy. Mm-hmm. So India and the Philippines are really important mm-hmm. partners for the anti-China strategy. There's just no way, like, you need India and the Philippines if you're going to mm-hmm. pursue an anti-China strategy. And these are two countries where authoritarianism and nationalism are very severe threats to the future of human rights and democracy in both of those countries. And they are largely getting a pass from Democrats. That sort of the approach from the Democratic side. It's about we need to build a new kind of international alliance to counter China. And what we've seen from the Republican side, certainly under Trump, like maybe different Republicans would handle things differently, but under Trump, even alliances with Europe were seen more skeptically. So Trump was very critical about European partners in NATO, applied tariffs to European countries as well as Canada. There's a sort of pure nationalism that we're seeing from the Republican side. Mm-hmm. So those are some of the differences mm-hmm. between the two approaches.
And to what extent do you think that COVID and the kind of connection of COVID to China is being used as a way to mobilize some of this sentiment in political discourse? To what extent has that been a factor?
I think it has been. It has been used. It's been a very powerful instrument in solidifying a new anti-China consensus. But I think it's not really the driving factor. The role that COVID played is that it's crystallized anti-China sentiments and sort of accelerated their development. But the trends were already well underway by the time that COVID arrived. So it may be COVID maybe pushed the timeline ahead, but the trends were already well in place. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so how are you seeing the impact of this kind of anti-China sentiment in the political discourse affecting Chinese and Asian communities more generally within the United States?
Something that has been encouraging to me in recent months is we've seen a number of AAPI groups take on anti-China political rhetoric from within the Democratic Party. So there was a significant controversy of this kind in Ohio, where Representative Tim Ryan, who is running for the U.S. Senate in Ohio, launched a campaign that was mainly focused on China bashing and scapegoating China for the economic problems facing Ohio workers. And in response to that, AAPI organizations at the state level within Ohio and also some national level organizations called out the Tim Ryan campaign and said that, hey, this kind of scapegoating rhetoric is part of what is feeding the rise in anti-Asian racism that we have seen in the past couple of years. So I think that is a real connection. There are now some pretty mainstream Asian American organizations that can see that and are starting to push back against Democrats who are engaging in that kind of rhetoric.
And for people outside the United States who might not be familiar with the abbreviation, AAPI is?
Asian American and Pacific Islander.
And also perhaps for people outside the US, is the kind of anti-Asian sentiment just something that's a kind of mood, or is it expressing itself in acts of violence or acts of kind of more organized discrimination?
Yeah, so there have been acts of violence. So it ranges from street level harassment to mass shootings. I think last week there was the latest in a series of shootings at Asian owned businesses in, I think it was Houston. That's just the latest example. There have been other attacks before that. We've also seen a steady trend in basically anti-Chinese racial profiling from state agencies, from the FBI, from some government agencies that fund research, like profiling Chinese researchers in ways that turn out to be, there have been a series of cases where it turns out that the agents responsible for investigating Chinese researchers were really just targeting because they're Chinese and there's no real reason behind it. We see this both at the street level and in government agencies. It's also worth mentioning that just last week there was a particularly complicated case where there was a church in Orange County in California where a Taiwanese immigrant engaged in a mass shooting at a Taiwanese American Presbyterian church. And this was motivated by the shooter's pro-unification politics. Mm-hmm. This is a thing from Taiwanese politics. most of Taiwan is, most of the Taiwanese population is opposed to unification with China. But there is what is now a minority of the Taiwanese population that is pro-unification, and pro-unification politics within Taiwan has a history of violence. So that is one of the factors underlying this shooting, but that combined with you know, growing tensions between China and the US and China and Taiwan, with the overall gun culture in the United States. And it also seems that the shooter had relationships with members of the far right, white nationalist politics within the United States. So, a very complicated set of factors that led to a mass shooting at a Taiwanese American church.
Right. And Toby, can you talk a little about the kind of longer history of this? I think a lot of people might be familiar with the kind of 1882 Exclusion Act that is, I think most people say describe it as the first kind of national kind of immigration control legislation in the United States. And that was directed at Chinese migrants. But can you talk a little, especially in the 20th century, about some of the kind of historical backdrop to what we're seeing today?
Yeah. So Professor Russell Jung, who co-founded the Stop API Hate project here in the US, has like a really good way of putting it that US foreign policy towards Asia is US domestic policy towards Asians. Mm-hmm. So when U.S. foreign policy turns against any given country within Asia, then people who are seen, perceived to be associated with that country can expect a rise in racism against them. So there are a number of cases. So in the early 20th century, when you know, Japan went to war against Russia and won, that was a shock to Europe, also a shock within the US, and seen as, you know, there's this growing, you know, Oriental threat mm-hmm. towards the white nations. Mm-hmm. And that was invoked as part of an argument for the rise of Japanese and Korean exclusion movements within the US, which were the heirs of the Chinese exclusion movement of decades prior to that. You know, we see also, of course, in World War II, the internment of people of Japanese and citizens within the United States. We see racism within the U.S. associated with the Korean War, with the Vietnam War, and actually racism, combination of racism and communism that came back to the U.S. following the Vietnam War. Became one of the seeds of the white power movement that then led to, you know, over the decades, things like the Oklahoma City bombing in the 90s. And then eventually that movement turned into one of the most committed bases for the Trump movement. Another example would be the war on terror and Islamophobia that came with the war on terror. So we see just this repeated pattern where US foreign policy starts to treat some part of Asia as an enemy, and anyone who looks like they come from there can then expect to be targeted both by popular street level racism, but also racism within agencies.
So speaking of the war on terror, so you know, one of the conversations that has struck me recently when I've been having discussions about some of this stuff with Muslims in the United States is this kind of perception that the war on terror might have now ended, and the kind of idea of a new Cold War with China is a kind of replacement for the war on terror, and that associated with that is the idea that kind of, you know, Chinese are the new Muslims, and that, you know, we the idea that the United States kind of always needs this one enemy, this one racialized enemy, as a foreign policy thing, and also then domestically, as you're pointing out, and now we're switching from the Muslims to the Chinese. What do you make of that?
I think that, I mean, it is true that, you know, there's a sense in which Sinophobia is getting more attention. There's more energy going into that. And there's sort of a corresponding decrease in energy around Islamophobia. I think it would be too, I was about to say optimistic. That's a weird word to use. it would be, I think, in a sense, too optimistic to say that the era of Islamophobia is now over, now that we have this new anti-China politics. I think, you know, Islamophobia is by no means ended in U.S. politics. It still has power on the right, certainly. And what I would say is that we're in a period where both Sinophobia and Islamophobia are like core ideological pillars for militarism. Mm-hmm. And also for right-wing nationalism. They are really coexisting in some ways, like feeding each other. I also think it's, it is true that having like the non-white enemy for the US to define itself against, that is a recurring phenomenon. It is important to the legitimation of U.S. nationalism. I'd be concerned about seeing this in like too instrumental of terms. Like it's not as if like anti-China sentiment got like invented to mm-hmm. serve this purpose. There are real developments in the world that that explain why it's having mm-hmm. more traction. Mm-hmm. And so there's a kind of like instrumentalist story that you could tell that I think is too simplistic.
Mm-hmm. It's not like a bunch of guys were just sitting in a room somewhere and said, aha, now we go after the Chinese. And then it all yes. kind of locks into place from there. No, it doesn't work like yeah. that, does it? Yeah. So can you talk about some of the organizing work you've been doing around these issues? Because I know that that's, you know, a major part of your work over the last few years.
Yeah. So, we have been developing analysis of US-China conflict and also trying to articulate what progressive internationalist alternatives could look like. But we've also been working on building power around that. So with Injustice is Global, we're engaged in grassroots power building. One part of the base that we're working with is members of directly impacted diasporas. So that would be a Chinese, but also Taiwanese and people from Hong Kong and that sort of thing. We are building a base within Justice is Global of like a leadership base, but also working with a broader coalition of organizations, and these can be like sort of pan-Asian organizations, but some organizations that are very focused on like Chinatown mm-hmm. Community organizing and that kind of thing. And so with this base of like directly impacted people, that's a core part of how we can build power for a progressive alternative. But we're also working on building coalitions with groups from other sectors who in different ways can see that they also have an interest in alternatives to US-China rivalry. So one kind of group that we've been working with is climate organizations. One of the places where there's the clearest need for progressive alternatives is around climate change. The US and China is the two top economies in the world, have to work together to defeat the climate crisis. And this is something that is very common sense. And so climate organizations have been good partners in understanding the dangers here. In addition to, mm-hmm. you know, foreign policy organizations, peace organizations, there are different ways in which I think a broad range of organizations and sort of the left to left liberal spectrum can see that the rising tensions and the rising anti-China nationalism are impacting their agendas in very damaging mm-hmm. ways.
And do you think there's any possibilities for building something like a kind of international class solidarity between like kind of working class in the United States and in China?
Yeah, I think so. It's the rise of nationalism, both within China and within the US, like does make that more difficult. The ideal way to do this is by building worker-to-worker solidarity and bringing together workers from China, workers from the US, organizers from China, organizers from the US. This had previously been some of the work that I was most interested in, excited about. But in more recent years, that kind of work of building direct solidarity has become nearly impossible as nationalism intensifies in both countries. In particular, within China, it has become too dangerous to work directly with labor activists within China. It just puts them at too much risk. So that kind of like direct solidarity building at that level is unfortunately next to impossible. But I think there is still work that we can do within the diasporas in the United States. Working with, for example, Chinese international students, many of whom have become engaged in social justice movement mm-hmm. Within the United States. Like that can be, it's sort of like, you know, they're in a very vulnerable position because they are caught in between these two great powers that are now coming into collision. But like that in between status can also be converted into a source of power and a place where we start to build a form of transnational solidarity. One place where this can work out is within graduate student organizing. There's a large population of international students from China enrolled in graduate programs within the United States. And many of these people have become leaders in grad student organizing. Mm-hmm. And these new grad student unions have become one of the growth areas for a number of labor unions within the United States. There's places where I think we can leverage that to build a greater sense of US-China international worker solidarity.
Fantastic. Okay, well, thank you, Toby, for sharing your insights with us today. Next month, I'll be speaking with Lynn Osome on how African governments have responded to COVID, and that video will drop on September the 21st. Make sure you subscribe to our YouTube channel so that you get that when it comes out. Thank you.
You're listening to the State of Power podcast from the Transnational Institute. This was a conversation between TNI associate Arun Kundanani and Tobita Chow, who is the founding director of Justices Global at the People's Action Institute, a network of state and local grassroots power-building organizations united in fighting for justice. This episode is part of a monthly series hosted by Arun Kundanani. Be sure to also check out previous episodes and look out for upcoming ones. TNI's material is all free, but we would greatly appreciate your help to keep doing the work we do. One of the ways you can help us out is simply to rate our podcast on whichever platform you're listening from, and please write us a review, which will only help us to get better at what we do. If you'd like to find out more about how you can boost TNI's work, please click on the Support TNI tab on our website, tni.org. If you have specific questions, requests, or suggestions for the podcast, please send an email to podcast@tni.org. You can also find us on social media at Transnational Institute on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Thank you for joining us today, and be sure to tune in next time.